From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Happy New Year! I don't think many of us are sad to see 2021 go, but truth be told, that's how a lot of people were feeling about the end of 2020. Still, we turn to 2022 with hope. But not before we take a good look at the year that was with Jack Jenkins, national reporter at Religion News Service. We'll also revisit our favorite conversations from State of Belief 2021. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest of the new year. Jack Jenkins is the prolific national reporter at Religion News Service, an incomparable resource for non-sectarian, non-commercial coverage of the many ways religion impacts our world and our lives. As we step into the new year, it's great to be able to look back at 2021 in Religion News with someone who reported on it so thoroughly. Please note that this conversation is taking place on December 16th, therefore breaking news of the last 2 weeks of 2021, say, winning or losing the war on Christmas, would have happened after this interview was conducted. So with that in mind, Jack Jenkins is with us again.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that introduction. I don't know if I deserve it, but thank you.
Let's start with the highlights. What would you include as the most important religion news stories or themes of 2021, and why?
Right. So I feel like the pandemic reigns supreme in terms of news stories in general. And I think it's fair to say that religion stories that intersected with the pandemic also tended to be large, although they shifted throughout the year. Early on in 2021, one of the prevailing narratives was the deep involvement of faith communities in vaccine rollout across the country. You couldn't attend a White House COVID-19 press briefing without hearing officials refer to their faith-based partners at the federal, state, and local level. This included faith leaders not only promoting the use of the vaccine, but also opening up their synagogues or churches or temples to host people for vaccination drives. It was a key component of the vaccine rollout and continues to be. And they represented the majority, according to polling, of religious Americans in terms of their support for vaccination. But as the year waned on, that story shifted to another story, which is that there continued to be a very vocal minority and a subset, but still a very vocal minority and subset of the U.S. population that not only was hesitant about getting vaccinated, but actively resistant towards an anti-vaccine sentiment. And over and over and over again, we saw an overlapping of religious sentiment and that anti-vaccine sentiment, quite often fused with Christian nationalism in particular. So you would see these events where people not only opposed masks in all varieties, but also vaccines, when they would gather together and they would iterate this call to America being a Christian nation, and at the same time envision a Christian nation in which people were not vaccinated against COVID-19. That story then also turned into the fact that there was many efforts by these religious actors, not just exclusively the Christian nationalist groups, but often led by them, to seek exemptions to vaccine mandates by invoking their faith. These were not necessarily always successful, which was a whole other batch of stories. But this pivot within these communities to embracing anti-vaccine sentiment, when that was not necessarily a central component of those faith traditions just 1 year ago, you know, during this year has been a big part of the year. Also, obviously, the oral arguments recently regarding a major abortion case was not only a large story about conservative Christians who've been advocating for, you know, rolling back, you know, gutting or completely doing away with the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortion nationwide, and the religious activists that are components of, you know, the anti-abortion movement, but also, interestingly, a very visible presence of faith communities in the fight for abortion rights. They were very present down at, in front of the Supreme Court when I went down there. You had people preaching two very different, often multiple varieties of theologies down there at any given time. And it looks like they're primed to be even more visible in the months to come as we hear more discourse and legal actions around the topic of abortion. I think those are probably the biggest top line ones because they involve any other ones, right? When Pope Francis is out there advocating for vaccines, that's a huge deal. And it speaks again to the role that faith communities play in that effort.
Do you have one or two topics that you would consider the most underreported or underappreciated religious news stories of the year?
Yes. So one of them is kind of connected to that. I think one of I should mention, because it's actually a part of answering this question. Another major news story from last year, I think one of the most largest religion stories of this year, it's just hard to remember it as still belonging to this year, was January 6th, the insurrection.
Oh, yeah.
The insurrection was an unapologetically religious happening. There was multiple different faiths represented there, but Christian national sentiment was a big part of it. I bring that up because the coalescence of Christian nationalist sentiment and anti-government sentiment, primarily anti this government, the Biden administration, has been an interesting story this year and how it's been attached to anti-vaccine and mask mandates, and how the faith, particularly Christian nationalist sentiment, but faith in general has been a common language in a lot of those movements throughout the course of the year. People have often covered these kind of conservative pushes back to Biden and to mask mandates and vaccines, what have you. But I think, you know, people often miss the forest for the trees by you know, not acknowledging the religious element, both be it in those more recent anti-vaccine protests or on January 6th. On the other side of the political spectrum, you know, one of the things that's been interesting to watch for me is that, you know, progressive religious communities and faith-led liberal and progressive movements have actually been very active this year. The Poor People's Campaign in particular, but actually several other groups as well, various groups of Black pastors, various different Jewish groups, Muslim groups have been very active in their demonstrations throughout 2021, advocating for a $15 an hour minimum wage, advocating for passing, you know, this Build Back Better bill, advocating for voting rights. I mean, the year kind of began post-insurrection with Black pastors in Georgia calling for a boycott of businesses if they did not push for a rollback of the laws on the that were ultimately put on the books in Georgia that they saw as infringements on their voting rights, right? We saw a lot of this activism. In fact, one of the largest peaceful demonstrations, mass arrests, peaceful demonstrations in terms of the number of arrests in American history happened this summer. It was a Poor People's Campaign event. It had all of these people mass arrested on Capitol Hill. And there was relatively little coverage of any of these efforts. These faith-based groups were arguably the largest protests in liberal activism in general in 2021, not just among, you know, their federal progressive religious cohorts. And I think that activism that was kind of calling for more progressive legislation, calling, you know, pushing the Biden administration and pushing Congress and pushing Joe Manchin in particular to support more liberal policies has been, you know, consistent and persistent throughout this year, even including marches throughout Texas, but has not garnered as much coverage as you would have expected, you know, those kinds of demonstrations to get.
Is it just me, or did we see a growing awareness at last of how powerful religion in its many forms is in helping drive politics, culture, society for religious and non-religious people alike?
Oh, for sure. I think
you know, there's definitely a recognition of the power of religion in all directions, if that makes any sense. I think there has been a greater awareness made, whether that was the insurrection or whether that was, you know, how unapologetically religious Joe Biden has been throughout his, you know, first, you know, year as president and throughout his campaign leading up to his election in November of last year. I think there has been some, you know, kind of normalization of that in a way that I, as a religion journalist, haven't seen in a long time. Now, as a religion journalist, I think there's also never enough done in the space, right? Yeah. But I do think there has been some sort of, you know, collective grappling with the continued role of faith in our society. And as you point out, what it means if people no longer affiliate with the religious tradition or claim, you know, a complete opposition to any faith whatsoever. What does that mean for the future of American society is a question that, you know, used to be, you know, bantered about in academic circles or some journalistic circles. Now is something that people could make the front page of a major newspaper.
Hmm. Well, this one is not a question I've asked in a year-end news roundup before, but it feels important to ask this time. Who were the winners and who were the losers, do you think? And what I mean is, did you see politics advance at the expense of religion, or divisiveness win out over unity and so forth? Who on your beat is happy and who isn't with how the past 365 days played out?
Well, I'll note one of the surprising things about the past year is I just noted for you a few different dynamics. One, this massive influx of faith-based activism. Mm-hmm. And that has split two ways. That has been folks who were protesting against mask mandates and vaccine mandates out in front of city halls and claiming their faith is a key component of their activism there. And people who are out in front of the Capitol getting arrested, calling for the passage of the Build Back Better bill, for instance. Both of those groups have been very active this year. And I think both of those groups are going to end 2021 relatively disappointed, right? So those efforts at getting religious exemptions to vaccines have largely been unsuccessful. Just recently, the Supreme Court has weighed in just recently, allowing for vaccine mandates to persist without a religious exemption in some places. I believe for medical workers, somebody can trust and verify me on exactly that case's nuance. The military, you know, there have been requests for religious exemptions to their vaccines, and they have largely gone unanswered. In fact, even former President Donald Trump's religious advisors issued a statement, a massive letter calling on the military to do this. And it does not appear, at least thus far, that the military is really granting much or any religious exemptions to COVID-19 vaccination. At least we haven't heard of any of them yet. Meanwhile, these, you know, progressive and liberal religious groups, you know, the pieces of policy they really wanted were things like the passage of a $15 an hour minimum wage, which was not successful in large part because of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. They wanted the elimination of the filibuster, which so far has not occurred. They wanted the passage of the Build Back Better bill, which so far has not occurred. They wanted the For the People Act, which was championed by Senator Raphael Warnock from Georgia, who was also himself a prominent pastor. But that seems to have been completely sidelined for a Freedom to Vote Act, which is not what one of those activists wanted. We're now looking at a situation where there might be action on voting rights by the tail end of 2021. We're not sure. It would require, again, amending the filibuster. And these are things that activists have called on and pushed for. And it doesn't look like they're necessarily going to get much or any of the things they were advocating for, including immigration reform, climate change legislation, things like that. So I feel like those groups have both kind of lost in that sense. But I will note, as a cursory element to all of that, you know, there has been this discourse in the aftermath of January 6th about the religious elements that inspired some of the people who, you know, raided the U.S. Capitol. And there has been a slow burning backlash to elements of particularly conservative Christianity, although not exclusively, about, you know, having carved conversations within a lot of those communities, particularly among white evangelicals. But again, not exclusively. There is also active Catholic contingents and many others, you know, saying, you know, what about our churches? What about our religious traditions allowed this to people to feel validated by God to participate in this? What about Facebook has informed those decisions? And I think that's a really been an interesting development to see that, you know, a lot of those insurrectionist groups are at least the insurrectionists themselves are in jail. Right. And while some of these folks continue to grow louder, you know, folks who may have not necessarily supported the insurrection, but been part of the group that was outside, you know, the day before, I think other folks are really having difficult conversations about those dynamics in their congregations and in their small groups. So I don't know if that's a winner or a loser, but I do think it's a shift, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
How much has religion changed this year? The reason I'm asking that is I'm thinking about how religion has been so central in the pandemic, in the divided nation, in what happened in the insurrection, all of those things. How has that changed, if it has changed, how has it changed religion in America?
No, I do think it is probably, at least in my reporting, what I can see. I have not done a quantitative analysis of this, so this is my conjecture based on off my reporting, not based on data. It does seem to have hardened some positions, right? So folks who have had critiques of, for instance, say, evangelicalism, have hardened in some ways those critiques in the aftermath of January 6th, that they see that as evidential of a tradition that they've long criticized. You've also seen folks who, you know, may say that they didn't support the insurrection, but they understood, you know, they understood why people were upset, for instance, is a way it might be phrased. Those folks might also be particularly hardened, where they're not necessarily, you know, preaching in support of the Proud Boys, but they are saying that maybe the general idea of God and country, and that the, you know, spreading misinformation about the 2020 election, saying, spreading erroneous claims that it's stolen, that they've only grown more vocal in that position. You know, the kind of this hardening of positions in either direction. You know, there is also some evidence that, you know, some folks have become disillusioned with faith altogether. But whether that means that they become irreligious in the fact that they don't believe in a higher power, or they, you know, that sort of thing, or if they just distance themselves from institutional religion, I don't have a direct answer to. Yeah. But there certainly has been some shifts in those regards. I'll also note the oddity of, you know, I wrote a story just before the pandemic hit about a fight over religious exemptions to vaccines in Connecticut. This is before this happened, right?
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting fight because not exclusively, but a lot of the people who were calling for religious exemptions to vaccines were, one, not articulating theological arguments often for why that was, just wanting the principle of having religious freedom in that area. But two, tended, or at least it appeared as such, that they skewed liberal, right? This was a small faction in liberal circles. Yeah. So what's been interesting is that now we have this element within particularly conservative Christianity in the United States that has now taken up opposition to particularly the COVID-19 vaccine, but perhaps the rhetoric is enough that it could be vaccines in general as a core contingent of their faith. And I'm curious if that survives beyond the pandemic, and if so, what that looks like, you know, a few years from now, when suddenly these positions that are so firmly held that they're willing to protest and not get vaccinated during a pandemic as an article of faith, what that would look like in a few different years, where it moved from some pockets of liberal groups to a deeply conservative Christian base. And so I don't have a great answer to that. I think it would be, there's some great academic and journalistic studies to be done there, but I'm curious about how that develops over time.
Well, your answer evokes another question. What do you anticipate driving religion news in 2022, and what kind of stories do you expect to be covering?
Well, I would love to tell you that I hope to never cover another pandemic story again. That would be great. I do not expect that to be the case at all. I think we'll at least for a time still be continuing to cover pandemic related stories. I do think the introduction of this new Pfizer pill might change the way we interact with the pandemic, and there's lots of speculation about whether that would make people less inclined to get vaccinated, and then, you know, whether that's religious, whether they hold their religious opposition to vaccines over to this Pfizer pill. I digress. I expect to continue to cover some pandemic related stories. Mm-hmm. The other subtext next year is that it's an election, right? And so, you know, we have seen no shortage of religious implications from Republicans or Democrats in the last year or in the 2020 election. You know, for instance, we have a pastor, Reverend Warnock, who is a U.S. senator from Georgia, right? And he is proudly identified as a pro-choice pastor. And that is actually not that incongruous with how people of faith actually express their opinions about abortion, but it has started these major conversations about religion and abortion and politics. And so I would expect that to continue be directly related to that. You know, where it looks like we're going to get the ruling on this major abortion case next year. And, you know, we've already started to hear some groups who say that abortion bans actually infringe on their faith, particularly American Jews, who say that, you know, the view of when life begins that's often postulated by some abortion opponents is not what their religious tradition necessarily teaches. There are also Christians who hold similar views. So I expect there to be a lot more interesting and perhaps unusual dialogue around faith and abortion that we haven't heard basically since before Roe v. Wade was ruled on. And I expect all of that to inform the 2022 midterms, which of course will also be informed by, I imagine some presidential candidates could even start announcing by the tail end of 2022. And given how early campaigns get started this year. And as they start to do that, you know, whether Trump goes in the fray, whether some new fresh candidates in the conservative side jump in, if they start to target the same demographics that Trump targeted, or if you have Democrats who are coming out strong, invoking a religious message from the outset, as some did when they ran for president in 2019 and 2020, I expect to conclude the year by writing a few of those as well. So that's my guesses so far. Okay.
We saw real attacks on press freedom in different parts of the world this past year. Often religion is a factor in this, blasphemy laws and so forth. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a growing number of people and organizations taking that seriously, and is it too late?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I will – it's an interesting question, because as a journalist, one thing I can tell you is that in general, after January 6th, you know, a lot of us are more concerned about our safety when we go out to report something. Right. Doesn't mean we don't go out and report on it. We just try to figure out whether we need a helmet and a slash vest while we do it. And we've had, you know, there was a journalist at a rally, a conservative anti-vaccine, anti-mask rally that also had some right-wing extremists there just this past summer, I believe, who was beaten up just for being there, right? Is at least that was the initial reporting. And, you know, a lot of different groups across the ideological spectrum can be hostile to journalists just for being there. This is not unique to one particular ideology in an increasingly polarized society. And so, you know, That sort of on the ground fear is not the same thing as some of my colleagues in other parts of the planet face, where it's a government that steps in and arrests them, you know, for blasphemy laws or you know, public officials that take them to task and try them for the things that they've written. That is a different and deeply troubling dynamic that, you know, so far, thank God, we don't have to worry about the same way here in the United States. But, you know, it is something I've started thinking about more recently in a way that I haven't in my entire career. And you know, I haven't gotten all of the gear that I would have to be used to be a war correspondent quite yet. But I have certainly, me and my colleagues and I have certainly checked the prices.
Last questions. What would you like consumers of religion news to keep in mind in the coming year? How can we stay informed responsibly and not get distracted by partisan bickering or religious propaganda?
Yeah, I think one thing that I would love to express to readers, it's a difficult thing to keep in mind for anybody who is religious or irreligious, is that religion is an incredibly difficult thing to define on its own, right? There's actually no universally agreed upon definition for religion, even among academics. And I bring that up because religion is often constantly contested, not only just the category itself, but also individual faiths. So when you hear someone make a proud faith claim, that doesn't make it disingenuous to that individual, but it doesn't mean that their version of faith is shared by anyone else, much less the vast majority of their religious tradition. You know, faith is a constantly contested space. So when somebody claims with authority that somebody else is a heretic or a blasphemer, know that that person might also feel similarly about them, that the person that they're shouting at them, they're shouting back, no, no, you're the heretic and the blasphemer. And that is normative in religion. It is a much broader, much more expansive place than I think we often give it credit for. And that means that religion can show up in so many ways and is present in so many different places that it can be easy to ignore if you don't think broadly enough to think of, oh, no, that is a religion, even if it's one I disagree with, even if it's one that feels weird, even if it's one that feels pretty new. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make it not a religion, nor does it mean that that religious expression is shared by anyone else or by the vast majority of people in their tradition. And also, you know, the interaction of religion and politics has never at any point in our history always worked one way. It often goes back and forth and ebbs and flows and looks different in different time periods or in different places. So I think it's a long-winded way of saying religion is complicated, and it's okay to understand that it will continue to be so. So whenever you hear somebody being very authoritative and their proclamations about religion is or what their religion is, keep in mind that that is going to almost certainly be a contested position.
Jack Jenkins is national reporter at Religion News Service and an always welcome guest on our show. You can see why. Jack is also the author of American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country. Happy New Year, Jack, good or bad. I know I'll be seeing a lot of the important events of 2022 through your eyes. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
We're just getting started with this week's show. You'll hear our favorite conversations of the year gone by. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Sister Louisa Derwin has spent decades of her ministry serving God's trans children. Sister Louisa, how wonderful to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege to be with you.
So, when did you first begin your work with transgender people of faith, and what caused it?
My initial desire and intention and belief of what God was calling me to was gay lesbian ministry. Back in 1999, I was finishing my term as vocation director for my congregation. And as I prayed about what comes next, I really felt the fire in my belly and God's call to work with gay lesbian people. I have gay lesbian people in my family, as most of us do, and I've had gay lesbian friends all my life. So I asked my congregational leadership if I could minister in that community, and they said yes, I could. So I didn't know any gay lesbian people in the city in which I was living, so I started going to PFLAG meetings, parents, families, friends of gays and lesbians. It was there that I met my first transgender person very early on, probably the second or third meeting. I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about transgender people, but I wanted to understand. So I asked Courtney Sharp, the woman who was at the meeting, if we could meet and for her to tell me her story so I could understand. So she came to my home, and in the very first conversation, as we spoke, she leaned back in her chair and she pointed her finger at me and she said, "You get this. You really do get this. And most people don't get it." Now, this is back in 1999, early 1999. Hardly anybody knew the word outside the transgender community. And she said to me, "For many of us, this is a profoundly spiritual journey, but we don't have spiritual people who understand us to walk with us." That was the beginning. She herself was Catholic and was the second oldest of a large Catholic family. And so she began to introduce me to tell other trans people in the community that there was a trans-friendly Catholic sister. They were very hesitant to approach me. She would ask me, has so-and-so contacted you? And I would say, no, they haven't. And she was puzzled by that because, as I learned, she was a leader in the trans community in the city and nationally. I was the first person that she met, and she said that to me. You're the first religious person who sees me as I am, who told me God loves me, and that I'm not going to hell for being transgender.
I wonder if you might be able to share one or two stories of transgender people that you've known over the years and highlight the timelessness of these experiences across many decades?
Oh, gosh. Oh, where do I begin? Let me begin with Courtney, the very first woman I met. She was she went to Catholic school. She was brought up in Catholic school. She has great respect. She herself has a great, great respect for Catholicism and what she learned. But she, tongue-in-cheek sort of, she says now, I learned well what my Catholic Church taught me. I learned well that every human being is a child of God and has dignity and deserves to be treated with respect. I learned that well from my Catholic Church. And so that's why I can push back when my church gives messages that don't align with the dignity of every human being. A few years ago, one of my trans folks was in deep, deep crisis mode with his faith, with the Catholic Church. And I remember one night calling me. He called me in the middle of the night, crying. He didn't go to church. He couldn't go to church anymore because he didn't feel safe in a Catholic church. And he would say, I miss going to Mass. I miss receiving communion. And he was crying. I miss communion. I miss Mass. But I'm not safe in a Catholic church. I'm not safe. The priest is going to say awful things about me.
Boy, yes. Sister Louisa, this is a terribly important question. In your work, have you seen any signs of organized religion in general becoming more open to the lived reality of its transgender members?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Definitely. Many other traditions than my own, other Christian traditions, are increasingly welcoming. And Catholic people themselves, the people of God in the pews, are increasingly welcoming of transgender people, and they're eager to learn and want to be accepting, very, very definitely.
Mm-hmm. Sister Louisa, what would you want every listener that we have to know about the possibilities of an authentic intersection between religion and trans people of faith, an intersection that blesses and benefits both sides of that equation?
Absolutely. My mantra to transgender people all of these years has been, the truth leads us to God, never away from God. Don't be afraid of the truth of your life. That is what holiness looks like when we live in the truth. And their process of transitioning is precisely, explicitly, and profoundly a holy process, a holy journey, because they are moving from a false self that everybody tells them they are, claiming their own life narrative and their own authenticity and their own integrity to live in truth. That's what holiness looks like. That's what gives glory to God, when we live our lives authentically and in truth. We are not separated from God. And I see that. I've seen it hundreds of times. After transition, people are much closer to God. You know, in 101 prayer lessons, we cannot go to God as we are not. We can only go to God as we are.
Sister Louisa, we need to write that down, and everyone listening, look at that over and over again. Truth never leads us away from God. Sister Louisa Derwin is a member of the Dominican Sisters of Peace. Her ministry to transgender persons began in earnest in 1999, and she has reached some of the most marginalized people of faith around the world. She is now semi-retired in Central Kentucky. Sister Louisa, you will always be welcome on State of Belief Radio, not just as a guest, but as a sister.
Thank you so much.
There's more of our favorite interviews from the year just ended coming right up. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum has been leading Congregation Bet Simchat Torah in New York City since its founding in 1992. Recognized as the largest LGBTQ plus synagogue in the world, CBST offers education and leadership on many essential issues facing today's world. And so it's no surprise that Rabbi Kleinbaum has been doing the same for decades, including her time on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. President Biden says he wants her back on that commission, and he's far from alone in wanting that. And I welcome you back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and I'm the president of your fan club. I find you one of the deepest thinkers about religion in America today. So thank you. It's an honor for me to be with you today.
Well, thank you, Sharon. When did you previously serve on this important commission?
So Senator Schumer appointed me in December of 2019. So I began in January of 2020. So I was only on the commission for a couple of months when COVID hit. And here in New York City, those first few months of COVID were terrifying and very difficult. We went into an immediate lockdown, of course, and our illness and death rates were off the scales. And as a congregational rabbi, I just felt that I couldn't fulfill my responsibilities to my congregation, which was in total crisis with illness and death and fear and anxiety, and also serve on the commission as fully as I thought it responsible to do. Mm-hmm. So I stepped down in April of 2020 so that I could really focus on my congregation and on our COVID crisis here. So I was very honored when the president approached me about being reappointed for this new term, which will go till May of 2023. Mm-hmm. And Of course, I accepted when things looked like they were really going well back in June, 20 years ago in June of 2021. And I'm hopeful that that we will be able to, I will be able to do this position with my current congregation. And I'm going, I have a 6-month sabbatical for my congregational work, and I'm doing some projects during that time, and this will certainly be one of them. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has kind of a multi-level agenda. One is to, on behalf of the President and the Congress and the State Department, to be able to be a little bit of a watchdog and aware of what's going on internationally, and the focus is international. This is not a focus on domestic issues, with the prism of religious freedom. And then to make reports back to Congress and the Senate and the House of Representatives and President and the State Department on thoughts about what's happening in a whole list of countries related to the issue of religious freedom. There is no other body in the United States who has that responsibility. And as you know, President Biden cares very much about human rights, and he cares very much about religion. So I think under his leadership, the commission will really be able to do wonderful things. I don't yet know when travel will begin again to those countries, so I'm not quite sure about the travel part. So the commission does hearings and works with Congress and brings in experts like a congressional hearing would look, and does it in order to develop a annual report, which is issued in May each year, analyzing various countries that are on different kinds of watch lists, and with the expert staff of the commission, develop a report that recommends to our government how we should look at these particular countries based on their track record around issues of religious freedom. And it's complicated.
It is complicated.
And so that, and by the way, the website is a fabulous place for anybody who cares about international issues related to religious freedom. It's USCRIF.gov, USCRIF.gov. And it has the annual reports listed. Some of the hearings that USCRIF does are open, and now with Zoom, you know, how easy is that? Fantastic to participate. You know, and it'll do just issued press releases about issues about religious minorities in Afghanistan, for instance, and Northeast Syria, and Muslims in China. So it's a very, very, very exciting place to be right now. And since so much of my work as a congregational rabbi is dealing with religious issues here in the United States, I'm very excited to be extending that and learning more about our international world.
There's no question that the political religious right in this country has been expert at harnessing well-intentioned programs and agencies in the service of a narrow vision of
exactly.
a theocratic world as they wish it to be.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The Commission on International Religious Freedom has been no exception at times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's less of a concern right now? And if so, why?
Well, the commission is a bipartisan commission. And as such, it reflects some of those partisan issues. I'm pleased that it's bipartisan, by the way, and I'm mm-hmm. happy to serve with people whose views are quite different than mine. And the atmosphere and tone is, by and large, very collegial and focused on this. So it's now a majority Democratic with a minority Republican, and that switches back and forth. So, yes, there's always that tension about how religion will be used. And we know religion can be a source of great liberation, mm-hmm. and it can also be a source of great oppression.
Talk about the identities that you bring to this role and mm-hmm. to this moment, if you would.
Absolutely. I am the only Jewish person on the commission. There are two openly gay people, and I'm certainly obviously the only rabbi. So I certainly bring a lot of sensitivity to the issues of anti-Semitism in the world as it now exists, and we are watching anti-Semitism explode across the universe in a way that is breathtaking. And likewise, there's also been a lot of confusion about when is it possible to be critical of Israel and when is that criticism anti-Semitism. And there's some very serious and very good discussions about that. And I think I bring to the commission a lot of sensitivity about those discussions and a lot of nuance about how to approach it. So I'm very grateful to be in that position to help think that through. And obviously, as an openly gay person, I'm able to also bring sensitivity because the intersection, as we've talked about, of LGBT issues and religion, honestly, that's been a hot-button intersection for a long time. I often say that LGBT people have experienced different kinds of persecution. Yeah. One is that the medical or psychological world has called LGBT people sick. Criminal justice systems or law enforcement have called us criminals. And religion has called us sinners. And some societies, in America is an example, we've made tremendous headways about medical, you know, pathology of gayness being removed from the DSM, et cetera. And we've made a lot of headway about changing laws. But one place in which anti-gay, I'd say kind of the tsunami is growing strength is from right-wing religious groups. Mm-hmm. And they are forming, strengthening, I think, those opinions. And we saw it under the Trump administration kind of fostering that hatred a little bit, even more in, among some right-wing religious groups of all persuasions, by the way, Jewish, Protestant, Catholic, and it exists as well in the Muslim world, yeah. In the right-wing world.
How do you define religious freedom?
I define religious freedom, first of all, the USERF itself, the commission itself, obviously looks to the International Declaration of Human Rights as a source to look at international issues. But I do believe that every human being has the right to express and to practice religion and their relationship with God and to practice no religion. Religious freedom to me also includes the right to be a non-believer and to do it in a way that has respects other people as well. And that's what's complicated for some religious definitions of religious freedom. Mm. We live on this planet with a lot of people who are quite different than each of us. Mm. And I believe God wants us to respect those differences. B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, each of us is created. Not just one type, not just one religion, not just one race, not just one gender or gender expression or sexual orientation. Yeah. So to reflect God, I believe we have to start from a place of respect and learn and go from there.
Sharon Kleinbaum is the founding rabbi of Congregation Beth Simchat Torah in New York City, the largest LGBTQ+ synagogue in the world. Well, Sharon, you've always been helpful to us, and I thank you so much for taking time to being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Blessings to you, your family, and all your listeners.
We're looking back at 2021 with our favorite conversations from a difficult year. E. Ethelbert Miller is a literary activist and author of two memoirs and several poetry collections. A keen observer of the human condition, Dr. Miller is the perfect guest to launch our Black History Month coverage with. Ethelbert, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
What are the ways that cultural dominance being threatened has expressed itself in the reassertion of privilege?
Well, I think what happens, we live in a time of social media. We live in a time in which language has been, I would say, corrupted. You know, we have words that or slogans that can become harmful that we don't think through. And that's the other thing that I think is really affecting how we exist as a society. I like to think of the fact that our level of decency has declined. It might sound a little old-fashioned, but you know, as soon as you stop spelling words correctly, as soon as you start like twittering and trying to condense language, I think there's going to be some implications of how we how it affects our society. You know, there has to be guidelines. You know, and I'll give you an example. In social media, if you post something, say on Facebook, you know, all of a sudden you say, okay, how many likes did I get? Well, yeah, you can get a lot of likes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean it's good.
Okay. Right.
The same way, for example, you can see the danger that we have. And I'm a baseball person. We've gotten into analytics. We got into numbers. So when you turn on the TV, let's just say the CNN, and you see in that right side these numbers of COVID, well, then you can ask yourself, at what point when they stop posting those numbers or those numbers begin to go down, at what point will we return to being to a sense of being normalcy, you know? Mm-hmm. Is it all based on numbers? You see? Mm-hmm. The same way, for example, we see a lot of society in conflict, and some of it is the fact that it's a battle of narratives. Okay, if I mm-hmm. watch Fox News, that's one narrative. If I watch MSNBC, that's another narrative. Okay? And what I find is the problem is sometimes the same things are not being covered. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know, not that it has a slant, but something is just not getting covered. And so some people just, oh, I didn't know about that. You know, and that's how it is when we think about Black History Month, you know, this month now. You present certain things to white people and say, oh, I never heard of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. I never heard of Juneteenth. And they don't know. And they're good people. They just don't know. And mm-hmm. that was not part of their narrative. And then what happens is time. If I try to find time for your narrative, then I may have to cut out something of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's just like if you're a teacher. And you say, okay, I want to introduce more things about women, more things about indigenous people. What are you going to take out? You only have a certain amount of time. And that's the battle where we are right now in terms of sharing power and sharing decision making.
Mm. I'm sure you would expect me to ask this question, and it is an important one for our listeners. How significant do you think the religious component of this has been?
Well, religion is key. You know, I strongly believe in what Lewis and King always talked about, and that was the beloved community. You know, if we go back to Martin Luther King, the book that came out after his death, you know, where do we go from here, Chaos or Community? The community that he's talking about is not the Black community, but the beloved community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the challenge. I feel that if we have leaders that don't have a moral compass, that's going to be a problem. If we have teachers who teach us facts and figures but not ethics, we're going to have a problem. You know, I always raise a question, and this was a number of years ago when I was at Howard University. I was always concerned about whether if a student was in a school of business, would he or she take an ethics course?
Hmm.
Okay? Because I've been around on university campuses, and because like many institutions, they go through financial crisis and they have to cut things. And so what happens, you'll be sitting in these rooms, and what are they going to cut? They're going to cut the philosophy department. Why? Because they're looking at numbers. Oh, there's not. We only graduate three graduate students in philosophy. Let's get rid of that. Okay. And what happens? Not realizing that here is the importance of the humanities. Okay. That you can't have people becoming scientists and engineers and doctors and lawyers unless they have access to understanding the key questions, which are spiritual questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
who are we? Why am I here? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you don't have a spiritual base, then you can work for the oil companies. You can destroy nature because you have a certain view of like, okay, the market comes first. That's your mm-hmm. ethics. Those are your values.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so if you don't have a spiritual base, you can't go far. And then what we have to look at is even if you have a spiritual base, if it's been corroded at the bottom, okay, where all of a sudden you've gotten away from the basic fundamental teachings of, say, Christianity or Judaism or Islam, then that's going to be a problem. Because where you have those little cracks in the foundation, that's where sometimes the nationalism comes in. It fills a little space where all of a sudden you think that your faith is the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's my thing, is what I see happening today in terms of this moral or spiritual presence hardening mm-hmm. to such a point that it's becoming like more Old Testament than New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Is there one important consideration that you see being ignored in earnest but often simplistic conversations that we're hearing around race and justice in 2021?
Well, you know what happens? If being an artist, you have to be hopeful, even if you paint pictures of despair. You know, even if you write books that, or you sing the blues, you have to be hopeful. That's what you do. You know, I feel that as an artist, my job is to sort of like explore the wilderness, you know, to prepare for what could come. You know, I want to see the possibilities. That I think is key. But then in terms of what the challenge is, it's very simple. And people like Baldwin writes about it. We're caught up in a lover's struggle in a society. And if you look at that battle, the struggle, if you ask yourself, it is very difficult loving one person, okay? you know, like, there's a lot of bad marriages out there. There's a lot of relationships that are not making. And what happened? It's work. And if you don't want to put the work in, then you don't know what love is, okay? You know, and that's the challenge, okay? You know, we've had over the last few years the best chance and opportunity for all of us to finally understand what's in our Constitution.
Okay? Yes. Yes.
And this is the catch. What we don't accept is that there's two constitutions, okay? Not the first one, you know, that everybody wants to cite, you know, La Scalia. No, it's the second one, the one that emerges after the Civil War, the one with all those little amendments, okay? That's the second one, okay? That's the one if you're gay or you're disabilities. Yeah, all those things in there where you're expanding it, okay? That's where the Constitution begins, okay? And it begins at the same time that we've had a civil war. So we had to start over again and get it right, you see? And what happens is that the same way people want to put up Confederate monuments after, you know, Reconstruction to push especially black people back onto the plantation, make them sharecroppers or something, you see right now in 2021 trying to take those monuments down because there's a movement, okay, that has to fulfill the promise that we had after the First Civil War. We can't go through that again, okay? And this is the thing that if we don't have a moral compass, like say like someone like Lincoln, you can't get through this. If you cannot stand up on principle, you know, this is what John Kennedy wrote, and a principle, you mean to tell me that you are going to be in a party and support somebody that doesn't believe in 9/11, you know, the Jews have some sort of laser, you are going to stand with that? I don't know how you can go home and love your family. I don't understand that. And this is a challenge where right now, what we saw happening yesterday, for me as an artist, I have to be hopeful that, like in Jonestown, that the grilled cheese sandwiches and Kool-Aids are not being handed out.
E. Ethelbert Miller is a literary activist and author of two memoirs and several poetry collections. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I hope we can stay in touch. Many blessings.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air, and we are grateful. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.